Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, online at excellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, straight from his Martha's Vineyard vacation with the Obamas, Rick Hess.
Hey, how you doing, Mikey?
I'm doing good, Rick. How about you?
Good. You know what? It turns out the president is not a good body surfer.
Is that right?
He kept getting all stuck full of horseshoe crabs, and I have to yank him out and say, sir, you got a horseshoe crab in your thigh.
Mm-hmm.
It was... And I got to say, I'll take him out of your calves and your feet, but I'm not taking the horseshoe crab out of his thigh.
The key thing is no pictures of him windsurfing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's now become, you know, after the John Kerry incident a few years ago, that mm-hmm. is off the list. Politicians not allowed to do that sport.
It keeps shrinking. It's kind of like after Dukakis put on the helmet to go in the tank
yep.
and looked like Snoopy.
Right.
They stopped wearing the helmet.
Exactly. All right. Hey, Rick, we got so much to cover. I'm like on fire. I feel like I've had a bunch of coffee today and I haven't even. I'm just so excited.
How excited are you,
well,
buddy?
I mean, there's stuff to do. We got Race to the Top. We got this new report that you've authored for Fordham. We've got, and we've never even talked about the whole LA value-added data thing. There is a lot to cover. A
lot of substance, baby.
So let's get started.
Let's do it.
With Pardon the Gadfly, let's go. Intern Kyle, have at it.
So there were some surprises with the announcement of the Phase 2 Race to the Top winners. Care to weigh in?
Well, Kyle, yes, I would. Okay. So, Rick, we've been tag-teaming this week and mm-hmm. some commentary and quotes and such that Louisiana, Colorado left out of the winner's circle.
What, how do you want?
Ridiculous? Preposterous? Disastrous?
Ludicrous?
Ludicrous? What's going on with this?
It's amazing. It's amazing to me to have a contest which purports to grade states on not just on good intentions, but on their traction on school reform. And to say that Colorado and Louisiana are not two of the nation's dozen leading school reform states, mm-hmm. but to suggest that Ohio, Maryland, New York, Hawaii mm-hmm. are. In fact, Duncan on the press call today explained that Hawaii did particularly well because they got great marks on their presentation. Mm-hmm. Is this eighth grade social studies? Is this Mrs. Bannister saying, gee guys, I really like the way you spoke about your report? I mean, I thought this was supposed to be about track record. I thought this was supposed to be about legislative accomplishment.
I mean, did they wear those little grass skirts? Is that what?
You know what? The most significant and useful thing to come out of the whole last year was Mike Johnson's Senate Bill 191 in Colorado. If I'm Mike, if I'm Dwight Jones, mm-hmm. the state chief in Colorado, right now I'm feeling like this administration has just told me that's all swell and good, but you guys got to get some better dance shoes.
And let's be clear. I mean, so it looks like they just funded down the list that the peer reviewers gave them. But that is not their only decision. I mean, they had the discretion to look at that list and say, okay, something went wrong here. Colorado, Louisiana, they've got to be on this list. We're going to overrule the peer reviewers and set this right. Now, granted, they would have faced a huge firestorm, the criticism from people saying, hey, that's playing fast and loose. We might have even made some of those arguments. And they would have angered the teacher unions who hated the proposals in Colorado and Louisiana. But that would be politically courageous. Instead, they just went with the
Now, you made the point, Mike, that, you know, partly the well for that kind of behavior has been poisoned by reading first. Mm-hmm. That there's a precedent here where you can just, you know, get your head handed to you if you try to use that kind of discretion at the department.
No, that's right. But I think we took the wrong lesson from reading first. I mean, what happened with reading first is that the department used some discretion first in rewarding grants. Some states they made come back 6-7 times before they got funded. And then in monitoring, they would find out that some state was using its money for whole language programs, and they went after them. I think the only mistake with reading first was that some of that wasn't more transparent. But it wasn't that the administration was using its discretion. You need to have discretion. These competitive grant programs, it's not a science. But everybody knows Louisiana and Colorado should have been on that list. Shame on the administration for not making sure.
Last point is, look, a bunch of these states that won not because they're reform meccas, mm-hmm. but because they promised to do things.
Yep.
Governors change. State chiefs change. They don't follow through. It's going to be real interesting to see whether the department actually goes back and tries to claw back the money from these states in future years.
Right. But isn't the money supposed to be stimulating the economy? Okay, topic number two.
Fordham's report, The Best and Worst Cities for School Reform, came out this week. Rick, as an author, tell us about it.
Hold on. Rick isn't just an author. Rick is the lead author.
In this report, we said that there is a way that we usually talk about school reform, which is, are superintendents doing a good job of forcing these large urban bureaucracies to get leaner and more effective? And that's fine. But if you look around the world, usually breakthrough improvement is not the product of leaders managing to make large, unwieldy bureaucracies get better. Usually it's the province of new, more agile entities coming in and getting the work done. So what we said in this report is that we think cities which are going to do school reform right are going to be mixed systems. Systems where the districts are getting better, but where they're also creating welcoming environments in terms of money, in terms of talent, in terms of opportunities and quality control for non-traditional providers. We ranked the cities, the nation's 25 largest cities, and a handful of other oft-talked about cities on these criteria. Finishing at the top was New Orleans, of course, Louisiana, which was not around to race the top winner. Finishing in second place was Washington, D.C., and finishing in third was New York City.
And by the way, fourth, Denver, Colorado.
And another state that didn't make the RTT cut.
All right, good. So Rick, people are going to say, hey, this is all nice and all, but you know, some of these cities aren't exactly known for having strong student achievement results. I mean, in, say, New York City, there's all this brouhaha recently about its test scores and, you know, that in fact it's not doing all that much to close the achievement gap. I mean, what do you say to that?
I say that's, you know, perfectly legitimate. In this report, we were real explicit. We didn't look at achievement or student graduation rates. Look, what I would say is when the World Bank rates countries on economic performance, they say, hey, our judgment as to best places to do business in terms of how hard it is to remove an infective employee, in terms of how easy it is to open a new business, don't map onto GDP rates. Mm-hmm. These are leading indicators of what are going to put countries in position 5, 8, 10 years out to do a lot better. Mm-hmm. That's the way we suggest people think about the ecosystems report.
Okay.
Is our cities putting themselves in a position for 2015 and 2020.
Okay, excellent. Okay, topic number three, Kyle.
Some have criticized the LA Times for making data on teacher effectiveness public, while others have praised it. What does this development mean for ed reform?
Yeah, so Rick, I saw Mr. Pansy over there, Rick Hess.
You know me, baby.
Oh, maybe the LA Times shouldn't have published this information after all.
I'm an old softy.
All right, so I have to admit I was lucky. I was on vacation for this whole brouhaha, so I get to look at it after the fact. I've read all the stuff. Look, I buy the argument that as a journalistic enterprise, this was perfectly legitimate. They went out and they wanted to make public information more accessible to the public. And they say, hey, parents should have a right to know in a given school which teachers are more effective. I think there's an argument for that. That's different than a policy argument about whether the government should make that happen or enable it. I think the more interesting story that's totally gotten overlooked, though, is what some of the findings were. And we got to get this into people's heads. What they found, and some other research has started to find, is that you can find ineffective teachers and effective teachers in the same schools. And there's not that much variation from school to school. It's not that all the great teachers are in the cushy schools and all the bad teachers are in the poor schools. Can somebody give this message to Education Trust and some of the other groups that keep trying to, as you always say, Rick, strip mine teachers from suburban schools?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, it's also, again, you know me, I'm all in favor of using value-added as an evaluation tool. I'm all in favor of using it as a tool to remove teachers. I'm all in favor of using it as a tool to pay teachers. I pretty aggressively defended DC's impact system just a couple weeks back. But I'm real concerned about this increasing habit we have to talk about good and bad teachers in terms of their value-added scores on reading and math. Mm-hmm. The minimum sample size for these teachers was 60, which gives you actually a pretty substantial degree of slippage. Depending on how you operationalize your value-added system, these numbers move.
Blah, 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 blah.
So let's be real careful before we kind of say that these numbers tell us who is absolutely and confidently a good or a bad teacher in that system.
All right, fair enough point. But we can say confidently who is absolutely a great member of this podcast team, and that is Amber with her research minute.
Amber! That wasn't me.
And Amber's going to get into like frequencies, so hopefully you guys can spice it up after this minute.
Okay, Amber, what are we talking about
today? All right,
so
we've got the new annual ACT results.
Amber!
Called the condition.
Crowd's going wild.
Is he
going
to like shut up during my minute?
Rick,
the condition of college and career readiness, ACT's new report, examines the extent to which graduating seniors in the class of 2010 are college and career ready by analyzing how many certain benchmarks on the ACT test they meet. So this is basically a minimum score that indicates you've got a 50% chance of obtaining a B or higher in a first-year credit-bearing college course. So bottom line, 47% of all 2010 high school grads took the ACT. That's a pretty good number. We see that their test results have remained essentially the same since 2006, even though more of them are taking the test and the testing population has become increasingly more diverse. In the past 4 years, average composite scores for most students has inched up or stayed flat, except for African Americans whose scores have inched down. The headline, though, is this: less than a quarter, 24%, of high school graduates taking the ACT are academically ready for college coursework in all four subject areas. That would be English, reading, math, and science. Though this is far better than 4 years ago, when 21% made the mark. Once again, only 4% of African Americans met all four benchmarks, compared to 39% Asian and 30% white. This was interesting to me. My last point: more met the English benchmark than the math, but the science benchmark, not the math, was the most challenging, with only 29% meeting it.
And Amber, remind us, what percentage of students take the ACT?
So 47% of 2010 high school graduates. So that's pretty, you know, big number. It's gone up. It used to be 40% just 3 years ago, I think.
But so, and what percent of the others, do we know what percent of the others are taking the SAT?
I don't have SAT numbers. Nope.
Because, I mean, one of the interesting things is, right, that 24% is actually probably an overestimate. Because potential college goers are taking this. Folks who aren't at all prepared aren't taking it in the first place.
Right. And you won't, exactly. And still the bar is pretty low, 50% chance of getting a B, you know, a B. So already the benchmark isn't.
Well, that's depressing. All right, one more number here off the top of your head. So in terms of the number of kids that go to college, it's what, about 65-70% of the matriculating class will start college of some sort?
I think it's about 65%.
Yeah, 65. Yeah. And then how many are graduating four-year degrees?
Oof. Well, I mean, boy, I mean, well, you know,
in
I mean,
the neighborhood of 20%, 25%.
Well, remember, less than half that population is going directly to four-year institutions, I believe.
Right, they're going mostly going to 2 years.
That's and right. of the folks who are going to 4 years, completing within 6 years of when they matriculate is something like 50%, give or take, nationally, 40-50%.
Whew, wow. So when we're talking about all students college and career ready, we're either kidding ourselves or we got to be real serious about what we mean by career ready.
Long way to go.
All right. Amber, do you think that their standards, do we have any reason to know if they're kind of legitimate? Are these scientifically based?
You probably know this. So they survey college professors, and they ask college professors, what skills, you know, and knowledge do you expect your students to know in your course, in your first year course? So it's based on the, you know, the perceptions of college professors, that we think they're valid.
But the whole 50%, you said, you know, there was a 50% chance of them getting a B. Is that based on some data?
That's actually empirically derived. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can go into the details, but it's definitely empirically derived. I mean, ACT actually has a very good reputation for those benchmarks. And I mean, of what we have, it's probably the most rigorous. I mean, in terms of, you know, a lot of this other stuff is just, you know, opinion, and this is opinion, but it's pretty large sample in terms of the survey responses from professors.
Bottom line, we're screwed. That's bottom line. Hey, by the way, Amber, I'm surprised that you came on. You could have tackled this other issue that you're tackling this week on Fox and Friends.
I could have.
You want to tell us what that topic is about?
Oh, man, that's just killing me. So Boston is apparently spending some money on some training for making teachers more culturally sensitive. Cultural sensitivity training. Our friend Bob at UVA.
Oh, Bob Covert.
Bob Covert, who I love. You know I love Bob
Covert.
Is
Bob doing the work with Boston?
No, he's not. But it's sort of like giving them that multicultural training. So, you know, I'm basically going to say we got bigger fish to fry in a tight economy. So since most of these kids really don't need to be leaving high school, we have Please Do Not Go by the Violent Femmes. Love this stuff.
Please do not go.
Lovely. Well said. You know, there's a large genre of music around, you know, don't go or should I go? I mean, you could have gone a lot of directions with that. Mm-hmm. Should I stay or should I go now? I mean, that's stuff like
okay,
that.
Okay, but I do have one question. So you've mentioned this show to me before. What exactly is Fox and Friends?
Fox and Friends? Oh, it's just a talk show on Fox News in the mornings. It's like their Today Show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And Amber is now a regular guest. I think she's been on something like 4 or 5 times now. Every time there's a breaking education story, Amber Winkler is the one they call. Love it. Okay, now it's time for us to rate that reform.
All
Now, Stafford, you're back in the Rate That Reform chair. I hope it's okay to tell our listeners that you have a little bit of surgery coming up on your wrists.
I do, and yes, that is okay.
Which makes me think you're going to be in a sling that's going to make it hard for you to do some of your work, but I don't see any reason why you couldn't rate your reform while in a sling.
Nope.
All right, so you'll be here next week to rate that reform. Excellent.
Yes, on painkillers and in my pajamas.
Okay, good. All right, well, what are we rating this week?
So in 2009, California State Superintendent Jack O'Connell announced that the land of milk and honey was handing out dry crackers, not brioche. $17 billion in cuts would be necessary through 2011. That's still $2 billion short of the state's expected education shortfall by next summer. But standing outside the Robert F. Kennedy Community School in downtown Los Angeles, you'd never know. This brand new facility, which was the converted famous Ambassador Hotel, where RFK was assassinated in 1968, cost Los Angeles Unified School District a whopping $578 million. The complex, which will house 4,200 students, is just one of a crop of what's being called, quote, Taj Mahal schools that are cropping up around the country. Yet RFK Community School is perhaps the most pointed begging of the question, what is the relationship between student environment and student achievement? And does student environment warrant this kind of investment? So the fact that California is in serious debt, almost to the point of absurdity, I think clouds the issue here. Yes, clearly it is crazy that a state $19 billion in the hole in education would spend over $500 million on one school. Yet even if these were plush economic times, to spend that much on one building is still absurd. There's surely another end to this spectrum, where crumbling walls and broken glass prevent learning. Who could forget the gruesome pictures of Detroit shuttered schools from a while back? But that's no reason to swing in the opposite direction. We have plenty of high-performing charter schools, for example, that operate in ideal circumstances and manage to overcome. That should teach us one thing. The quality of education is based on what's going on in the classroom, not the shape of the walls surrounding it. I give this one an F.
Ooh. I wonder what Jonathan Kozol thinks about this.
I'm sure he's touched. You know what's interesting? If you had taken that $578 million, mm-hmm. if you had put in an endowment for the students who go to that high school at, say, paying out 4.5%, 5%, you could give each student who goes to that high school now and in forever $7,000 a year just in interest payments off that corpus. So you could, every student in their 4 years of education would amass $28,000, which would basically fully fund them to go to any school in the California State University system. And that corpus would be in existence forever. Instead, we have put all of that money into a concrete facility. It's amazing to me.
What on earth is in the thing that made it so expensive?
An atrium, state-of-the-art gymnasium, cafeteria with wireless, you know.
Wow.
All the typical trappings of a high school.
Now, I got to say, I mean, I've been to McDonald's that have atriums and free wireless.
Right.
And I believe they were put up for something like $14 to $16 million at most. Mm. Some of them put up for $3 or $4 million. So I'm still a little befuddled as to exactly where the money went.
There's also a marble tribute to RFK himself, as well as the fact that they have maintained part of the walls of the Ambassador Hotel.
All right, well, it's
for historical preservation.
That I respect. That's fine. Yeah. So, okay, we'll concede that some of the cost here was about historic preservation or about this landmark site. But come on, people.
Maybe a tenth of it.
You know. This is ridiculous.
Indeed.
Okay, well, thank you. That is all the time we have for this week. We'll be back next week, including Stafford, we hope, even though her wrists will not be in working order.
From Skype,
I
guess?
She can come in jammies. This is radio, not TV.
You're practically in your jammies right now, Rick.
I'm a little comfy, I got to say.
All right, till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.